Hello, everyone, and welcome to the May 2026 IASB podcast. I'm Linda Mizon-Hutter, the vice chair, and I'm happy to be here with Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Linda. I'm also happy to be here. I'm Bob Yule, an IASB board member, and we're here to talk about the May 2026 IASB meeting we just completed. In that meeting, the board discussed 7 projects over 3 days, and today we'll cover 3 of those topics: intangible assets, statement of cash flows, and business combinations, disclosures, goodwill, and impairments. That's kind of a mouthful, and we're going to kind of refer to that as BCDGI. And then at the end, we'll give an update on important decisions for the other topics, but if you want more information on those, you can always go to our website. Linda, why don't we start with intangible assets and maybe a little bit of the background on the project?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And, you know, Bob, I've been getting a lot of questions about what's happening with this project. So I think it's cool that we're going to be telling them some good stuff about this. So I remind everybody that the intangible assets project was launched in response to a request from our third agenda consultation. And stakeholders were very keen and said this is an important area. And so last year, we set 2 main objectives for the project. One was to improve the usefulness of the information that entities provide about intangible items in their financial statements for the users of those financial statements, and also to take a good look at IAS 38. And I always remind people that when we have a standard that starts with IAS, that means it's a bit older than the standards that start with IFRS, although we go into those standards periodically and update them. But we're going to look at the sum total of IAS 38 and make sure that it's suitable for the newer types of intangible items and the new ways of using them that we see in today's world. And let's face it, in today's world, things are changing really rapidly. So I want to remind people that this is a large project, and I've said that the world is evolving a lot in this particular area. And so when we're doing our comprehensive review, we're trying to do it in a very focused way. And we have 2 streams of work that we're working on right now. One is, as I said, looking at user information needs, and the other is exploring potential changes to the definition and recognition requirements based on some test cases. So we've already carried out some extensive research on both these streams, and the exciting news is that Bob is going to give us an update in terms of what we discussed this month, but I'll remind people that we also began discussing the test case work stream in January.
So this month, we focused on the investors' information needs. And as Linda indicated, this is an area that is changing very fast. But why do we focus on the investor information needs? Well, intangible assets have become much more important in driving a company's profits in today's economy. You see it in the news. We are talking about intellectual property, software, patents, and brands, just as some examples of these intangible assets that are driving companies. And the types of intangibles and their importance varies by industry. You see the importance in pharmaceuticals, in technology companies, telecommunication companies, and entertainment. And yet, while intangible assets are so important, investors say they are not getting enough information, hence the importance of identifying their needs. Over the last few months, the team has been researching this area and talking to investors. At this meeting, the team brought their findings for the board to discuss and ask questions about, but they didn't ask for any decisions. Now, to put this in context, one of the key messages the team said that they learned from user outreach was that users are seeking to understand how intangible assets and activities around intangible assets drive future cash flows and overall business performance, rather than trying to seek the value of individual intangible assets in isolation. And from that, they identified 4 key challenges that analysts have raised in looking at intangible assets in the financial statements. First one is linking spending to outcomes. The users struggle to assess whether intangible-related expenditures are actually generating value. For example, they see spending on marketing programs, but there's no link on how it affects revenue growth. Another issue is linking the narrative to the numbers. And what I mean by that, they often see companies in their management commentary describing intangible related activities, such as launching a new artificial intelligence initiative or a marketing campaign. But then when they look into the financial statements, they don't really see a connection from the management commentary discussion to their financial statements. A third challenge is comparability. Users often mention challenges related to diversity on how entities capitalize versus expense intangible related costs, particularly in the area of research and development. And then they also have challenges comparing entities who grow organically or create their own internally generated intangible assets than those who acquire intangible assets through acquisitions. And finally, the fourth challenge that the team identified is insufficient information on recognized intangibles. So what I mean here is they don't find enough information about the useful life because oftentimes those are described in very broad terms. And there's lack of information about impairment disclosures and the post-acquisition tracking of acquired intangibles. Now, I'm going to slow down here because I want you to remember this. This is a key finding. In terms of improvements, most users indicated preference for enhanced disclosures rather than broader recognition of internally generated intangible assets. That is, they do not necessarily want to see more intangibles in the statement of financial position. What they want is more to understand how an entity's intangible activities affect the value and cash flows rather than knowing the cost of an intangible asset on the balance sheet. So specific requests for improvements included greater disaggregation of intangible-related spend, better evidence of outcomes. They also want clearer explanation of capitalization policies, amortization, and impairment decisions. Users also want more information on how intangible assets have performed after an acquisition. Now, we all realize that some of this information may be commercially sensitive, and investors understand that. And so one of the jobs of the board will be to figure out how to balance the costs and the benefits here. So Linda, why don't we talk about a little bit more about this meeting?
Sure. There were a few things that I thought were also interesting to help us, scope out what we need to do. So there was some additional evidence presented by the staff from credit analysts and lenders, also from consultative groups and research. And this broader evidence helped us understand where user information needs overlap and where they differ. For example, we heard about the more conservative emphasis from credit analysts and lenders on downside risk and debt servicing capacity, meaning, is there enough cash flow to pay the obligations? That's pretty basic. But they still point broadly to disclosure improvements rather than wider recognition. So there was a difference, but then there was a similarity. So in terms of next steps, we started a conversation this month on whether these findings could change the priority of topics for the board to explore in the project. Should we focus on something that we hadn't anticipated sooner rather than later? And also our approach to exploring them. So in the coming months, we plan to ask our consultative groups for their views before we make any more decisions in terms of project direction. I also note that the work stream that explores potential changes to the definition and recognition requirements based on the two test cases, which I'll remind you, are cloud computing and agile software development test cases, that continues in parallel, and you'll hear more about that in future meetings. So Bob, pretty exciting news on the Statement of Cash Flows project. You want to tell us about that?
So moving on to our next project. Reminder, the Statement of Cash Flows project was added, just like the intangibles, from strong demand from our stakeholders in our third agenda consultation. Now, I want to emphasize here that the initial research was really important in scoping this project. What we heard from both users and preparers was it's a very important statement, but what they wanted was really targeted improvements and not an overhaul of the statement. So the objective here in this project is to assess potential ways to improve the requirements in IAS 7, again, an IAS standard, so an older standard, but again, looking for improvements to that, like they are looking for in the intangibles projects. So some similarities. From users, what we heard was they want better disaggregation of information and strengthening the link between the statement of cash flows and other parts of the financial statements. They want more transparency about non-cash transactions, and they want extension of what we did in IFRS 18 with respect to management performance measures to include cash flow performance measures. From preparers, we heard that they would like more application guidance to achieve consistency in application of classification of cash flows and the definition of cash equivalents. And then we heard from both users and preparers, and we're going to consider as a part of a later stage how we might accommodate financial institutions within the statement of cash flows. As both have indicated, it has less use for the statement has less use for financial institutions. So this month's meeting, we focused on two aspects. One was improving the disaggregation of cash flow information, and the other was with respect to information on changes in liabilities arising from financing activities. On the disaggregation and linking issue, the problem identified is a lack of information that enables users to understand how the disaggregation of line items in the statement of cash flows differs from related items in the statement of financial position. So, for example, you might see the label accounts receivable in the balance sheet, but then you see changes in trade receivables in the statement of cash flows, and is not sure if they're the same thing or if there are differences. And there's also some issues around aggregation in one statement and not the other. For example, you might see in the statement of cash flows changes in working capital, but then not knowing what items in the balance sheet actually make up working capital. And then another issue that's been identified is cross-referencing to the notes from the primary financial statements. Notes often include information both about the statement of financial position and the statement of cash flows, but you don't often see that cross-referencing. So now, in order to strengthen the link between the items in the statement of cash flows to the related items in the statement of financial position, the board tentatively agreed to introduce application guidance. That really wasn't controversial. And they provided the staff with suggestions for drafting application guidance to be a bit stronger about what an entity needs to think about in providing those links between those statements. Now, with respect to changes in liabilities from financing activities, now IAS 7, the standard on statement of cash flows, already requires an objective and requirement to provide information about changes in liabilities arising from financing activities. Think about like debt. Both in terms of cash and non-cash changes. Now, the standard suggests but does not require that a way to provide these changes is to have a roll forward to go from beginning of the year balance to how you then ended up with the end of year balance. Now, despite the requirement, investors sometimes struggle to link the IAS 7 disclosures about changes in liabilities from financing activities back to the statement of cash flows and to the statement of financial position, because either the information is not provided neatly in the roll forward, or the roll forward doesn't provide links back to the primary financial statements. So the board tentatively decided to proceed with, instead of IAS 7 suggesting a roll forward, to actually requiring a roll forward where, and I'm going to paint the picture here, you could have the columns that relate to the liabilities that provide financing, and then you would have rows within, beginning with the opening balance, the changes, and coming down to the closing at the end of period balance for those liabilities. Now, one controversial part of this is that some companies include more than just financing liabilities in some of these tables, in these disclosures of these roll forwards. For example, some have an alternative performance measure called net debt, where in addition to the debt, they have included cash equivalents. After a bit of discussion by the board on both sides of the argument, though, the board tentatively decided not to proceed with proposing a requirement to include in the roll forward other assets and liabilities such as cash equivalents. So it will be just for now, under this tentative decision, just those liabilities related to providing financing. Now, the board discussed whether it should further explore ways of incorporating net debt into financial statements, but also, again, here decided to drop that aspect. So next steps on this project, as I mentioned, the areas for target improvements. So there's still much to discuss in the areas of non-cash transactions, cash equivalents, and classification of certain cash flows. Let's move on to our third project we want to discuss, which was business combinations, disclosures, goodwill, and impairment, or as I mentioned, BCDGI. Now, business combinations can be the most significant transaction in the history of a company. And goodwill from a business combination can be one of the most significant assets in the statement of financial position. Yet investors may not receive sufficient information about the performance of the acquisition, the support for goodwill, and prepare a struggle with the complexity in this area. For this month's discussion, we're just going to focus, and we just focused on the disclosures for a business combination, including the subsequent performance of the acquisition, which in the first few years can be critical. This fits with the project's objective, which is to improve the information companies provide to investors about business combinations, albeit at a reasonable cost. To date, the board has discussed feedback from constituents on the proposal to disclose from certain business combinations the key objectives and targets, and for all material business combinations expected synergies, and has discussed making some refinements, but has not really discussed the potential for benefits and the cost of providing this information. Which, Linda, that leads us into the discussion at this month's meeting.
Thanks, Bob. And boy, this month's meeting was pretty interesting. So if you didn't get a chance to listen to that yet, I would encourage our listeners to go back and listen to the playback of this discussion. So our focus was to stand back and look at what the staff now calls the overall package of performance and expected synergy disclosures. And just as a reminder, there's three elements here that we're focused on. One, which we call the key objective and targets, the COTS, so to speak. So the requirement to disclose these items for a subset, those business combinations that are either 10% of the acquirer's assets or the acquirer's revenue, and to extent to which these targets are being met in subsequent periods. That's one element. Second element is what we call this expected synergy disclosure. So some quantitative information about the expected synergies by category, which would include estimated amounts, cost to achieve them, and the expected timing where these will be done. And the third element is having an exemption that would allow an entity to be exempt from these disclosures in terms of this information in specific circumstances. And most of those circumstances would be the notion of commercial sensitivity. So disclosure of this information would harm the company in a way. So this month, the staff analyzed other feedback, including on auditability. They presented their suggestions on how to adapt or change the package of performance and expected synergy information to deal with some of these concerns. The board wasn't asked, actually, and this is important, wasn't asked to decide on the details of the package at this point. But they were asked whether the benefits of the package of performance and expected synergy information justify the cost to preparers to deliver. So it was an interesting discussion because on the one hand, we had board members that said, no, the benefits don't justify the cost because users of the financial statements are not likely to receive the information they would have expected from the project because we've scaled it back. On the other hand, other board members said the benefits of the overall package of performance and expected synergy information do justify the costs. Even if the benefits are smaller, they move the financial reporting forward, and it's an improvement from what we see today. In the end, it was a close vote. 7 out of the 13 board members voted that the benefits of the overall package and expected synergy disclosures did justify the costs. So where does that leave us? What are the next steps? The staff will come back and present the ISB with further analysis on the package, and we'll ask the board to decide on the package and other aspects of the proposed amendments at a future meeting. So stay tuned. It's kind of like where you don't know what the sequel is. You have to stay tuned and come back for the next episode. Now, there's a few other things we discussed, and they're also important. So I'm going to give you a couple of brief updates. One is on our provisions project. So this month, the board finalized the details of a model for possible application requirements for levies. So I'll just remind you that we have an interpretation on levies, and we needed to incorporate, you know, guidance on levies in the revised IAS 37, or we'd be incomplete. So this notion of really settling on these requirements is an important step ahead for the broader project discussion we'll have, and we expect to make that in June. And then that will take stock of the full picture as and how we're going to proceed. Next topic is the fair value option in IAS 28. And we had done an urgent consultation on this, given the upcoming effective date for 18. So you say, why are you changing IAS 28 because for IFRS 18? Well, this is because we had some jurisdictions who were interpreting the ability to use the fair value option in IAS 28 much more restrictively than what the board really intended. And this is important because if you use the fair value option of IAS 28 for certain entities, for certain investments, those investments are accounted for in the operating line versus the investing line. So very important because we're honing in on this hopefully better definition of operating profit, and we want IFRS 18 to deliver those results in this respect. So we expect to finalize the proposals on this fair value option with some minor editorial improvements, and we expect to issue the final amendments next month, so stay tuned for that. Now, we also got a place card from this discussion, which is those people who supported this piece of the amendment supported a wider amendment in terms of an unrestricted fair value option so that anybody who wanted to use this fair value option could do so. And after discussion, we decided that likely the best place to park that will be in our upcoming agenda consultation that isn't too far away. We expect to start on it by the end of this year. So stay tuned on that one as well. And one little point there, if we did go to the wide open fair value option, that would converge our approach with U.S. GAAP, which is important to many of our investors who follow companies who report on both GAAP. So let's keep that in mind, too. In terms of our famous equity method project, the ISB would discuss feedbacks on proposals for transactions with associates. And this shows where we can be flexible because we made a surprising decision, but one that I think is a pragmatic decision. So we've agreed to allow companies to make an accounting policy choice of how they recognize gains and losses on transactions with associates. They can either do so in full or restrict to the extent of their interest in the associate, with one important exception, and that is when you do a transfer of business where the gain would be recognized in full. And we also decided on some enhanced disclosures so that users can understand the accounting policy applied and its effect on reported gains and losses. So users won't lose any information. As we know, when you do an accounting policy choice, you inhibit comparability, but we'll give in disclosure the information so that users will have the comparability. They can make the necessary adjustments they need. We also made an important decision with regard to our risk mitigation accounting exposure draft. We extended the deadline on the comment period from the end of July to the end of November. And this will then allow the comment deadline to align with the fieldwork deadline. And this allows the companies who are doing fieldwork to have full knowledge of the results of their fieldwork as they finalize their comment letters. And for us, It will also allow us more time to conduct some further education and outreach. And in particular, and if you're listening to this and you're a smaller entity and you're still on IAS 39, this proposal could affect you, because one of the things we said in this proposal is we need to withdraw IAS 39. So please, if you're in that camp, please take a look at this aspect of the proposal and let us hear from you. And finally, regarding our consistent application activities, we agreed to explore whether to amend IFRS 18 to require or allow an entity to classify non-income tax charges that meet the definition of covered taxes in the Pillar 2 model rules in the income taxes category. We haven't made a decision whether it's one line or two lines, so stay tuned for that. The staff will come with their finding to the board in the next few months, and we also agreed to defer a decision about the related IFRS Interpretations Committee agenda decision and updates to two other agenda decisions to a future meeting until we make decisions in this regard. So that's it for this month. Thank you, stakeholders, for listening. Please look forward to next month updates, and here's an advertisement. Next month's update will include the last appearance of our current chair, Andreas Barco. He and I will be here to do a fun-filled dialogue between the chair and the vice chair. So tune in for that, please. And for now, goodbye from the IASB.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take the time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Please contact us on communications@ifrs.org with any questions, comments, or suggestions. You can also sign up for email alerts on our website, ifrs.org, or find us on social media.